Going to be looking at the tithe this morning. It is, in my opinion, one of the two things that you touch most lightly in people's lives. That is their money and their children. You can talk about anything regarding anything, but when it comes to people's money and children, that's the most sensitive I have found. That seems to have the most potential for all kinds of various responses. Now, I want to say, as I speak on this morning, I have the wonderful privilege to speak in a context in which and to a people who have a practice of giving, and giving regularly and giving faithfully. But over the last month, I've had the occasion, and the subject has been brought up several times, about tithing and some questions in people's minds as to how it's appropriate to tithe and what it is to tithe and where does it fit in regards to the church and things like that. And I had determined at the time that it would be good to have teaching on our giving and tithe and what that all means, and to do it at a time when it can be known that I'm not doing it so that people will start to give. Not doing it at a point in time in which our funds are low, and if you don't give by the end of the week, we'll have to go off this television program or anything like that. I have the luxury of speaking at a point in time and to people that this is not and need not be interpreted as a scolding or to put everybody on notice that everybody else is failing in their giving. And it's a wonderful opportunity to speak. Much better than to speak a year from now when there's a crisis in finances. If there had would be a crisis in finances, better to speak than to speak at a time in which several people have come under temptation and yielded to it to cut back on their giving. Better to speak now on it without all those factors in play, and people could say, oh, he's preaching at me this morning. Better to speak on it now to set the train on the right tracks so that as it builds up steam, it's going on the right tracks rather than have to correct it and bring it back and get it on the right track. Better to speak on it now so that as we're established in our understanding about this and as other people do start to attend Gospel Truth Fellowship, it is already established and understood and a working principle among all of us so that others can simply hear of a common understanding and a common practice, and that it doesn't have to be something that is started from scratch and we don't have to correct ourselves in midstream and such. So it's all approached from this standpoint. It's approached from the standpoint that we need teaching on it. And the questions that were raised to me caused me to do some really good thinking and to really see some really good things for my understanding and to see the significance of some things and to see how it plays into our lives. I could speak about this from the standpoint of showing you the scriptures in the Old Testament about tithing. I could show you that Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek when he met him along the way. And Hebrews refers to that and that Abraham paid tithes. The word tithe means tenth. Simply the word means tenth, 10%. And it's in the law. It's required the people pay tithe, 10% of all of the increase of their labors, 10% of the increase of the trees and the vines and the ground and of the herds. That whatever grows off the trees or grows on the vine, and what comes out of the herds, 10% of that is to be given to the Lord. And that was what was required and dictated to Israel through Moses, and that is what the practice was in Israel. Now, it's important to notice that the reason why that was appointed as well, that God established his tabernacle under Moses, later it was built into a temple under Solomon, and it was appointed that the descendant of Levi named Aaron and only Aaron's descendants would be the priests that ministered the sprinkling of the blood in the Holy of Holies and certain things in the temple. And that the other sons of Levi, the Levites, were set aside to administer all the other things that had to do with the temple. Bring the wood in, put it upon the altar, see that the altar stays lit. washed the utensils. Every day there was what's called the showbread that was baked and put out in the temple up before the Lord, called the bread of His presence. And every day it was baked fresh. And then that was taken out. And next day, new bread was baked fresh and laid it out there. And then they had the incense that was kept burning, representing the prayers of the people in the tabernacle of God. And they had the burning candelabra, the burning lights with the whatever those are called, lanterns or such. And so there's all these things to take care of and watch over and keep everything clean, and the slaughtering of the animals and handling the articles of the animals. All those things were taken care of by the Levites. And God did not give the Levites any land. He took that tribe and appointed them to take care of the temple. Then He called upon the people to give a tenth of their increase and bring it to the temple, and it was to provide all that the temple needed for baking this daily bread and the morning and evening sacrifice. They were to offer up a lamb every morning at the dawn of the morning and before the sun went down at night, every morning and evening sacrifice. Well, where are they going to get these things? Well, they came out of what the people brought, out of their herds. See? Where are they going to get the wheat to bake the bread every day? It came what the people brought. They brought it to the temple, and they gave it to the Levites, and the Levites stored it up and watched over it, and also the Levites ate of it. That after they would sacrifice an animal or such as that, then the Levites would eat of it. And this is how the Levites were provided their room and board. And this is how the temple had sufficient number of personnel to perpetuate the worship that God appointed through these their various different instrumentalities and types and shadows and services and things like that. So to keep this machinery going of offering up worship to God and sacrifices to God and incense to God and animal sacrifices to God and the cleansing of all the utensils and everything, to keep that machinery going, it took people. And to keep the people going, it took food, things like that, okay? So they brought in the tenth, and the Levites then were permitted to eat it after it was offered up to the Lord, or certain portions of it they were permitted to take for themselves and feed them and their families, and they had families. Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, was a Levite. And what they did was they took 12 months of the year, maybe they might have divided the year in 24 sections, and then they divided the sons of Levi up proportionate to those sections of the year. And let's say that your portion of your tribe might have been 20,000 men or something like that. Your portion was appointed the first 2 weeks of January. So you would go to Jerusalem the first 2 weeks of January, and for 2 weeks you would be in the temple doing your responsibility for your time appointed in the temple as a son of Levi, as one of the Levites. Well, Zechariah was one of those people, and while he was there doing his portion of the year of service is when the angel spoke to him. That's what he was doing. He was in the temple doing his worship as a Levite to the Lord, and this is when the Lord said, come and talk to him about his son. He's going to have a son. And he shut his mouth because, remember? Okay. Well, that's what he was doing in the temple. He was a Levite. He didn't own land, or he didn't have any inheritance like the others did. He was completely dependent upon receiving what he needed for his supply through the tithe from all his brothers and sisters in Israel. Okay, so that's what the tithe was for. It was the means by which to keep the temple worship going. Okay. Actually, in Israel, some think there was even three tithes. There is the tithe that was brought up to the temple that the people were to bring and dedicate it to the Lord and give it for sacrifices and things like that. Then they believe there was a second tithe that was given to the Levite. And then every 3 years, a tithe was given for the poor. Others believe that second tithe was given to the Levites, not at the temple. The first tithe went to the temple. There is a second tithe that was given to the Levites because the Levites lived in various towns throughout throughout the nation. Okay? And they believe, and it's stated in the scriptures, that every third year a tithe was to be given, and the Levites and the orphans and the widows and the poor were to be supplied out of that tithe. So something that there's two tithes plus a third every year, meaning every 3 years is another tithe, and some think there's a tithe, and then every 3 years is a second tithe that goes to the poor and the widow and the orphan, and that's how they were supplied. And there's evidence to show that there was a second tithe. Now, at the time of Hezekiah that we read here in the text, 2 Chronicles chapter 31, verses 2 through 11, through 2 through 12, this is a number of years after Solomon, a number of years after the temple was in its height of glory and its proper administration of worship. And there had been evil kings rise and fall in Israel, and Israel had gone into idolatry, Israel had gone into a backslidden state. And under Hezekiah, there's a great revival takes place under his leadership. It's almost instantaneous. Within a very matter of a very few short months, all of Israel is attention is captivated and stirred and raised up. And under his leadership, him having the power to make decisions, we see that brought about a great revival in Israel. It's a marvelous study, a revival. And in chapter 30, King Hezekiah says that he's going to cause them to celebrate the Passover. But it's already the second month. You're supposed to celebrate it the first month. So he causes a Passover to be celebrated. He causes the temple to be cleaned up. He causes the temple to be straightened up. And the, as we will see here, that he, all the idols, the people go out and destroy all the idols. I spoke on this chapter one time before. He causes them to have this Passover, and he goes and invites all the remaining descendants of Israel in the north that had been left behind after they had been ravaged by Assyria. He invites all of his brethren to come down from the north and come to the temple area. We're going to have a Passover together. He invites all of Israel, and many just laugh at him, and they reject the invitation to come and worship God. But those that did come, he gives the Passover, and he provides all of the sacrifices necessary for the Passover. And it's a marvelous Passover celebration, and for 7 days they celebrate the festival of unleavened bread, and the people are worshiping God, and they're praising God, and they're rejoicing for this opportunity to have once again the privilege to worship God according to the way that Moses instructed them to, and it just says they were greatly filled with joy. And it says in verse 21, and the sons of Israel present in Jerusalem celebrated the feast of unleavened bread for 7 days with great joy. And the Levites and the priests praised the Lord day after day with loud instruments to the Lord. Then Hezekiah spoke encouragingly to all the Levites and showed good insight in the things of the Lord. So they ate for the appointed 7 days, sacrificing peace offerings and giving thanks to the Lord God of their fathers. Well, that went over so well and was such a joy to them. It says, then the whole assembly decided to celebrate the feast another 7 days. So they celebrated the 7 days with joy. And then they talk about the various contributions that the king made in order to celebrate more, with sacrifices of 1,000 bulls and 7,000 sheep and 1,000 bulls and 10,000 sheep from the princes. And all of the assembly was rejoicing. 14 days of continuous celebration with joy. Man, it's been a long time since Israel had known that state of worship and joy in worshiping God. This has really ushered in a real, true revival in Israel. It was very different than when Hezekiah took the throne. And it was just raising them up, and they were taking great pleasure in worshiping God. And it says, verse 26, so there was great joy in Jerusalem because there was nothing like this in Jerusalem since the days of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. See the magnitude of what's going on. Then the Levitical priests arose and blessed the people, and their voice was heard, and their prayer came to his holy dwelling, to heaven. Wow. Now look what happened as a consequence of this revival. Now when all this was finished, all Israel who were present went out to the cities of Judah, broke the pillars in pieces, cut down the Asherim, and pulled down the high places and the altars throughout all Judah and Benjamin, as well as in Ephraim and Manasseh, until they destroyed them all. Now, when it says pillars and Asherim, that probably sounds like they're taking down, you know, maybe their patio covers and stuff. But that's not it. Israel had adopted the two major gods of their surrounding pagan nations. The god of the Mother Earth and the god of the clouds of rain. And symbolized by statues of a graphic sexual nature, one symbolizing the male and one symbolizing the female. And people had these in their homes and offered sacrifices to them, and they had them in public places and in private places, and they brought their sacrifices to them because they had adopted the view and practice of their pagan neighbors, believing that if they offered sacrifices to the god of the cloud of rain, he would bring forth his great virility onto the earth and impregnate the earth so that the earth will give them their crops. And then they will also worship the earth, signified by a great fertile woman in a statue, and gave sacrifices to her so that she would receive this impregnation and be very fertile and produce a great crop for them. And that was the pagan religion surrounding Israel that they adopted for themselves. And they built these pillars and these asherim, female goddess statues, in their homes. They even had them in the temple. And they would give celebrations that the pillar god, or the god signified by the pillar, had done his job when the rains came. They gave praise to this god for the rains. And they gave praise to that goddess for the crops. I mean, this sounds absurd in our time, but this was really their thinking and their belief, and it's not so absurd when you go to places that are more primitive, even in our day. Back places in Mexico, places in the East, places in the Middle East, you go and they still have this thinking that it is the earth is a goddess, and there are gods who bring the rain, and they must appease these gods, or otherwise they won't get their rain. This is still going on. And this was what they had turned to. So instead of the Lord God Jehovah being blessed and praised for the rain and blessed and praised for the crops, Baal and the Asherah were praised for the rain and for the crops. They were given all the praise for it, all the credit for it. But after this 14 days of rejoicing and sacrifice and Passover signifying that they were covered by the blood that God appointed, that they had a renewed relationship with God, that with the instruments they praised God, and they were filled with joy, and they did it for 7 more days after the first 7 days, an extended revival meeting. What did they do moved by this joy and this worship? They went out and destroyed all of their idols. They went out and destroyed all those things that they gave credit to for all their bountiful supply. They destroyed them because they had been brought back to the knowledge of the true God and worshiped the true God and been brought to their senses to realize that this thing that they held there and they attributed such power to was just idolatry and darkness and unreal. And what did? They went out and destroyed them, A-L-L. All of them. Wow, what a pleasure it must have been to be the king. Huh? He didn't have to send out the army. He didn't have to send out the goon squad from the Levites. He didn't have to go out with any physical force to tear down the idols of Israel. The people had come into worship and joy, relationship, under the blood, and they themselves destroyed the idols that they had made. What a pleasure it must have been to the king to see that. I can tell you it's a great pleasure to me to see someone who has responded to the gospel, responded to the truth, and see them go and begin to destroy their idols. Out of their own heart, destroy their idols. Go reconstruct their home. Go reconstruct their families. Set everything in its proper place. Throw out the false notions. Stop giving false credit to false things and false reasons for living and false reasons for success and false reasons for blessings, and begin to give the praise to the real reason why we have life and breath and goodness and blessings, and it's God Jehovah. And to see people do that on their own. They know what to do. When God gets a hold of a heart and it's filled with joy, and there's under the blood of the Son manifested by the presence of the Passover blood there, they know where they fail before God, and they know exactly what they need to do. And those that are filled with joy and those that are filled with His presence, they go do it. They just go do it. They just clean it out. And you really don't have to sit down with them and say, well, what about this, brother? What about that? And then one case by case have them go, well, you know, you really need that, and well, I never have done without that. And you don't have to do that. There's such a willingness to get rid of all God, all the idols that oppose God. It just goes that way. Marvelous to see people who really do run as though they intended to win. Like Paul talks about. Run as though you're going to win. To see people start out and they run as though. They run as if. They run with a man, and they run with the intensity. They run with the drive. They run with the commitment as though they're going to win. That's the manner in which they're running. They run to win. It's a pleasure to see that. It must have been a pleasure to Hezekiah to see the consequences and the results of his willingness to make the sacrifices for the Passover, call the people to worship, make provision so that there can be this worship. He took the lead in it. He took the set the pace in it. He made the provision that they didn't have. He made it all possible. Then we come to the point where, after this joy and after they destroy their idols, and as he is reestablishing the worship of God in truth, and he's reestablishing their attitude towards God and their praise of God and their joy of God, he also reestablishes the worship of God in the temple. And in order to do that, he has to reinstate the Levites. He has to bring all the Levites to bear and have somebody make account for how many there are and who will take care of these 2 weeks and who will take care of those 2 weeks, and instruct them all as to what their duties are given their particular responsibilities. Kind of sets up a moral government there over the temple. And they have to be instructed and appointed their times and all that, so they know when to come. And then he has to call for the people to reinstate the support of the Levites so that the worship of God can be carried out. So that's what he does. And then in our text, we read it. Verse 4 and verse chapter 31, and he commanded the people who lived in Jerusalem to give the portion due to the priests and the Levites, that they might devote themselves to the law of the Lord. Now that portion wasn't something that he was making up, but he was reverting back to the instruction under the law that the Levites were to receive a tenth, a tithe. So he commanded the people to do this. And as soon as the order spread, the sons of Israel provided in abundance first fruit of grain and new wine and oil and honey and of all the produce of the field, and they brought in abundantly the tithe of all. As soon as they heard, revival still in their hearts. They'll tear down their idols and they'll open up their pocketbooks. They tear down their idols and they'll go pick and set aside for the Lord 10%. The things that come off the vine, the things that come off the trees, the things come out of the ground, the things come out of the herd. As soon as they heard, they're ready. As soon as they heard, boom, let's get our calculators out. 10%, 10%, 10%, all the way down the line. And they brought it in. Now, they just didn't bring in the first fruits, but they continued to bring in, because it says in verse 7, in the third month, which is the month after the second month when they had the Passover, in the third month they began to make the heaps and finished them by the seventh month. They brought them in and stacked up all these goods in heaps, piles, for 4 months. The heaps kept getting heapier. I mean, that's 120 days. Just day after day, these people kept bringing it. In other words, as they kept harvesting their crops and their harvests and kept picking and all, they just kept bringing 10% of it. And they just kept making these heaps, and just kept for 4 months,
these heaps kept being built and kept growing. What a sight. The temple was being replenished. The temple was being replenished of what had been let go and been neglected, so that now Levites could come. And the priests, meaning the descendants of Aaron, the chief priest, the high priest, could do his duties in sprinkling of the blood in the Holy of Holies, and the rest of the Levites could do their duties, because now they had these heaps. You see that? Without the heaps, you can't have Levites working. Without working Levites, you can't have worship in the temple. Direct connection. I mean, people might want worship in the temple, but God says it's going to be done in a certain way. And in order to do it a certain way, you've got to have a lot of hands on it. And a lot of hands have lots of mouths, and they're going to eat, and they need clothes, and all that. So these heaps of things provide the means by which the Levites can be there, which provides the means for the worship of God to be reinstated and carried on day after day after day. As soon as the people heard that the king is saying, we're going to reinstate worship, we're going to replenish what is needed in the temple for the Levites, as soon as they heard that, they began to bring in their cartloads, began to bring in their basketfuls. For 4 months they did that. Now, they had so many heaps that they had more than enough. And it says in verse 11, that Hezekiah commanded them to prepare rooms in the house of the Lord, and they prepared them. In other words, either build some. The original temple did have rooms on it outside of the holy place facing away. On the other side of that wall, they had rooms. In fact, they had lots of rooms in the temple area for priests to actually live in and sleep there at night and things like that. So there was lots of rooms. But they prepared rooms to take the surplus heaps and stack it up so that there would be an ongoing supply, so that when the crops weren't being harvested, the Levites would still have something to eat until the next crop came. You know, there's this timing of crops and things like that. And you just can't, it wasn't like you can go over to Lucky's every day and stock up the temple. Theirs went cyclical with when the herds reproduced and when the crops came in, and the crops came in at different times of year. So they'd take the oil, they'd take the olives and grind it into olive oil and stash it away for the anointing oil for the priests and things like that. And they would take the grapes and they would produce them into wine and set that aside. And these things could be preserved in that state. And so they were stacking up and replenishing the supply in the temple so that the Levites could have enough. And the temple could have enough so that the worship could go on. And so it says that the Lord has blessed his people and this great quantity is left over. The bringing in of the heaps. Remember, they're only giving 10%. The bringing in of the heaps is indicative of the blessings of God. The 10% of what God blessed them with when it was brought in was just a heaping amount of more than they could eat. So here's the thermometer to see how has God blessed his people this year. Look at these piles. You see it, follow me? The priest wanted to know, the king wanted to know how God is blessing his people, because God said he was going to bless them. It was going to be measured greatly by their physical blessings, the crops and the herds. There's one way God is going to indicate when they're in a state of blessing under him. So what's your thermometer for the gross national product? What's your thermometer in those days to see if God is blessing his people? You look at whether the temple is full or not. Right? Because it's 10%. Well, when you bring in so much, and it's still just 10%, the people weren't bringing in more than 10%. They were bringing in 10%, but when it's so much that there's great heaps that you can't eat it all and you have to stash it away for regular cycles of use, that's indicative that the blessings of God are great. Because they're just giving 10%. So a tithe means tenth. 10%. A tenth is tenth. A tenth is tithe. Now, if a person decides not to give 10%, then they shouldn't say that they're tithing, because they're not tenthing. Now, maybe you're ninthing or eighthing or eleventhing or something, but you're not tenthing. Okay? So it's important to understand what tithing means. Our discussion on Wednesday night about promise kind of blew my mind. Such varied ideas of what a promise is and its significance and its implications and things. It was quite a revealing discussion to me. It's very helpful to realize that our ideas of promise need a lot of help. And so when you tithe, you give 10. And you need to, you know, not call it tithe unless it's 10%. Okay? So if you're giving 9%, call it, you know, a knife or something, but don't call it a tithe. Okay? That's practical instruction. Now, in tithing or giving 10%, there people would be always giving the same. I don't mean the same person would be giving the same amount. I mean every person in Israel would be giving the same, 10%. And one person's 10% may be twice as much as another person's 10% in the absolute sense. But they're both giving 10%. So nobody gave more to the temple than anyone else did. You follow me? It's like the spirit of the law. When you love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, your strength might be twice as strong as somebody else. But they're giving their all of their strength like you are, so you're not giving any more strength than they are in the sense of the spirit of the law and this proportion. Now, your strength might do twice as much because you have more strength than someone else, but you're not giving more because you're giving 100% of your strength. So when you tithe or you give 10%, when Israel is given 10%, no one gave more than his neighbor. No one could say that he had invested more, given more, was more dependent upon him to give than somebody who gave half as much but was still giving 10%. You following? So it's a wonderful thing to have the principle of tithing or giving tenth, because everyone is giving equal sacrifice, equal giving, even though the dollar amounts might be very different. But everyone shares equally. And the person who has income of a comparatively low level is giving equally validly as one who has a higher income, but both are giving 10%. You follow me? So everyone can have equivalent participation in the sense that I'm talking about. Everyone can know that they are equivalently obedient to God, equivalently participant, because they are giving 10%. When you stay with a percentage of giving, then you have this wonderful blessing, this wonderful relationship with God and His work and one another, that you're all doing the same, giving 10%. That's one of the beauties of a percentage. But if you shift it to dollar amounts, if you shift giving to dollar amounts, then is the occasion for people to start thinking, well, I'm sure I give more than so-and-so, and to start thinking in terms of doing more, or more important, or the church is more dependent upon them, when you start thinking in terms of dollar amounts. Really, a percentage is the wise way to go, and I need not really say that, since God ordained, I believe, percentage giving for basic giving. And for the reasons I just mentioned. The purpose of giving is to sustain the work of the kingdom of God, to make real worship available, to provide the means by which worship of God can be centralized, declared in the earth, sustained, brought into existence and sustained, grow through giving. Now, God controls the giving. God controls the giving, because if he hadn't blessed his people so much, it wouldn't have been the heaps. It would have been just a tiny little pile. See? Follow me? Now, with that in mind, God controls the giving. God controls how full his temple gets by how well he blesses his people. So if there is no bottleneck with his people in giving, then he controls how full the heaps are in the temple is for his work. Follow me? Okay. I believe it's in this context that God addresses Malachi, the people of Israel, through Malachi. And then in that book of Malachi, he talks to them, and in an interesting dialogue, he asks them a question, and then he answers the question. Or he tells them something about themselves, and then he answers it by, or addresses it by having them answer with an answer, a question to him. How come we're doing it? How can you say we're this? In particular, Malachi, everybody preaches out of Malachi for tithing, and they say, you know, will a man rob God? And you say, well, how have we robbed you? And God answers, by your tithe and offering. You withheld them. You have withheld the tithes and offerings, and my house is empty. But also, your crops are, he says you're cursed with a curse. He says the reason you're cursed with a curse and your crops are low is because you stopped giving to my place of worship. So I've stopped blessing you because it's not getting where my blessings are intended to go. The reason that your crops are down is because I stopped my blessings because you stopped providing for the house of the Lord, the work of God. So since this doesn't get here, I'm not going to see that you get it here. I'm going to see that you don't get it here. And that's what he's saying to the Malachi. And he says, and his response is, look, prove me in this. I believe this is his sense of what he's saying to Israel through Malachi. Prove me in this. Take 10% of what you have and take it to the temple and see if I will not pour out the windows of heaven to pour out a blessing upon you, Israel, so that you will have more than you can contain. Prove my point. Take 10% and give it to the temple and see if I don't provide such blessings after you do that. See if I don't provide such blessings that as you're giving to the temple, my house gets very full. This is not really a promise to individuals as it was intended to be to Israel, to say, look, because of your bottleneck and not giving, I have stopped blessing your crops and your herds. But prove me. Take 10% of what you have and give it and see if I don't open up the blessings, because now they'll get channeled to my house. See? So prove me that your lack of blessings is my fault. Prove me that I bless you so that the blessings get to my house. Let's prove that. And he says, you know, let's have a test. And that's what he's talking about there. Tithing has been taught corruptedly, in my opinion, in such a way that it's always represented, God promises to bless you because you tithe, and if you're not blessed, you need to start tithing because he will repay you. That tithing is a mechanism that will cause God to bless you, an unbreakable cause and effect relationship. So if you're having financial trouble, it's because you're not tithing. So if you'll start tithing, all your financial difficulties will go away. Trouble is, that is laid out oftentimes or most times to people who are selfish, who are greatly in debt, who don't know how to manage their funds, who really don't give anyway, and it is offered as a way to get money with a promise that they'll get money. In most cases, it is offered as a fundraiser for the speaker and not a blessing for the listener. It is really to generate offerings and tithes for a church or a ministry, and in order to appeal to them where they are, they have to appeal to their desires and their own selfishness. And you can get people to give in that way, but nothing really changes in their lives because they are still in a state of opposition to God and rebellion to God. What they need to have brought forth in their lives is this great blessing of the blood and the great joy of worship and praise to God, and out of that joy go out and destroy their idols, and out of that state appeal to the people, it's time for you to participate in the ministry of worship to God in His temple, just like it happened under Hezekiah's time. And then the giving was spontaneous, and the giving was abundant and generous, and the great heaps. Okay? So tithing is not a mechanism by which, if you're broke, give and you'll get. Tithing is not a mechanism by which you sow seed into a ministry and God promises to give you 30, 60, and 100 fold back financially. All those ideas, I believe, are greatly detrimental to people in understanding about giving in relationship to God. God does not intend that if you give, He'll give to you. God intends to get the resources to His work in the earth. Anybody know who R.G. Letourneau was? I think he's dead now. You know what a caterpillar is? Not the animal. You know what a caterpillar is? A humongous earth mover machine. Tires bigger than this wall. You know what I'm talking about? And they go along and they scoop up the tons of dirt in one scoop. Well, R.G. Letourneau invented those. It's his company. And he was a professing Christian. And somebody we met back in Chicago knew him personally. R.G. Letourneau's testimony is that when he invented those things, instead of, you know, he was a believer and actively giving 10%. When he invented those things and things began to expand, he didn't go out and raise his level of standard of living to his level of income. But instead of tithing 10%, he started to tithe 20%. By the end of his life, he was tithing 90%. Of his income, because 10% was much more than he was living on and needed to live on anyway. Isn't that a radically different view of looking at finances? This world says when you make it and hit it and make it big, you raise your level of standard of living. Most people's standard of living is higher than their income anyway, sadly. But that's the idea. You just keep raising your standard of living if you start making more money. That's the spirit of the world. Which causes me to have to address, and need to address, debts. And this is a relevant subject to many of us in here because some of you are dealing with it, will deal with it for a long time. And living in sin is very prone, great proneness to being in debt. It is borrowing from the future for today's desires, today's plans. And our national debt is a disgrace and is a subject of great concern, at least during elections. But debt is what people take on when they really should not. Debt requires that what one may earn in the future is already committed and spoken for. Debt is a great robber of liberty and freedom in the present. If you have to live with past debt, it greatly robs how many hours you have to work just to pay debt, pay the payments on debt. It dictates how many years you have to work and those hours to pay off that debt until it's all paid, And those are hours and energies taken away from family and church and the kingdom of God and children. You may not calculate it like that, but it really does factor in like that. It weighs down upon your mind. It's a factor that you have to think about and address and make sure that your debts are paid off. And to everyone who is not in debt, don't go in debt. It's when people have it and they have to pay it off, they don't oftentimes calculate the difference it would be if they didn't have that debt. How much lighter the load would be and how much more in control they would be of their present life if they didn't have debts from the past. They could be free to move. They could be free to minister. That they don't have that's grabbed from them to a certain degree because of debt. And down the road, when your children get older and older and older, and they may have necessities for certain things, you may not give it to them because you're paying off debt. And it's not proper to go in debt. Because if you can't pay for it now, today, why do you think you can pay for it next month? You following? It's not reasonable to think that if you can't pay for it today. Now, credit cards are great conveniences. We use them. We pay them off every month. It's great convenience if you had to travel to a foreign country, not have to carry a lot of cash. Worry about losing traveler's checks. You can get a replacement by phone call. It's great convenience. But never should it be used knowingly that you are buying something that you know you can't pay for. You cannot pay off that debt when it comes due, but you have to extend it out and extend it out. Because every time you have a debt that extends out in the future, you are shaving off a percentage of your income. You're reducing your future income. Shave by shave by shave. You shave it lower and lower, percentage at a time. And having debt, factor this in, please. Having debt is no excuse not to pay God's portion. It's not. Now, having said that, I can realize the pressure that can bring it to bear on a person's mind. Pastor, you don't know how many bills I have and how much income I have, and you don't know the pressure between the two. Well, the pressure is caused by past debts constructed and brought into existence by sin, and the consequences of sin are no excuse for not present obedience to God. But it does produce pressure, and that's part of the consequences of having debt. It produces pressure. That's the kind of pressure I'm talking about when I say debt reaches over from the past into your present, and you have a sense of seeing your children, what you think they need for their well-being, your household necessities, and you feel the pressure between what you take home and what your sense of need is. Well, that pressure is, if you're in debt, partly made there because you're in debt. Not because God's requirements are too high, but you've created your own circumstance in which your present circumstance feels that pressure because of debt. I'm going to take the premise that tenthing is a principle applicable to us. We could say ninthing, or we could say eleventhing, but I believe that tenthing, or tithing, has a biblical background, has a biblical example, and is not anywhere in contrary to the spirit of the New Testament, or the spirit of the law, or the spirit of the gospel. I believe in our circumstances being so different than then that the people of God make determinations of how and where we're going to worship, and we make determinations of how we're going to construct our relationship with that worship, with our finances, and what responsibilities we will take together financially. And there has to be some kind of designated understanding of how we can guide our giving, and I believe tithing is a good way to accomplish that. And I believe tithing is to be done on the gross. Tithing is to be done on the gross. I can feel the pressure already. Hang with me. I believe tithing is to be done on the gross. Now, if you are someone who does not earn the income, is not responsible for earning the income, does not fall upon you to be responsible to tithe. It's not your responsibility. Isn't that good news? Okay? For you who are responsible to earn the income, you're responsible to see that your income is given to the Lord in a proper manner. And I believe that tithing is a principle for us to follow. I believe tithing on the gross is a principle to follow, because it's the increase that God has given us. Whether or not the government takes some, a lot, I think is a secondary question as to whether we have generated a particular income and acknowledging that God has generated that in our lives. If He has generated that in our lives through our skills, by bringing us into employment and such, we have to recognize, I think, that He intends for that level of blessing to be tithed on. I think that He knows how to give people better jobs, and He knows where people should be working, and I believe He knows that His level of blessing can be tithed on, whatever the government, whatever Caesar may do, and such as that. If you tithe on the net, it can vary from time to time. There are ways to have them take out much more, so that you can have much less net, and your tithe can be less. The laws of taxation can change yearly, every other year, and that will vary. Trying to be exact on 10% of the net can throw your mind into such exactness that you find yourself going, oh man, I'm trying to be exact. But it's just so easy to take 10% of gross and put first things first. And that's really a blessedness. And it's a mark of the blessing of God. 10% of gross, I believe God knows how to generate gross, and I believe He knows how to generate more gross when 10% of it is going to His work. Wherever that it is that you're committed that should go. He knows how to take, if it's going there, He knows how to increase the blessing. Not so that you have more, but that His work has more. I mean, that's really why He would bless, is that His work would have more. And I believe that the heaps that come in when people are giving and giving regularly and giving with joy, I believe those heaps help indicate to leadership what God is intending to do. I believe that when heaps of tithes are brought into God's house, it's indicative to leadership. God must be saying to us that there are things He wants to do that He's making provisions for. And what is it? Why are these heaps here? Why is the checking account bulging with these heaps? What is it you want to do, God, that you're making such provision? I think that is how God works, rather than the thinking. We have so few people here. We better get some more people here so we get the income coming in so we can grow. And I believe it's just the other way around. I believe the heaps speak loud and say, yeah, there's service to be done for God. There's work to be done for God. And here's the heaps for it. I don't believe a church should go in debt. I don't believe a church should be living hand to mouth, month to month, just barely cutting it. But I believe that God intends that there be heaps. I believe that we give, and by the way, for those who may have missed the message, Tony Phillips is no longer in Mexico, and he and I have agreed that we wouldn't send income to him anymore. He asked that we not do that, and I think some of you missed that message. So, and I need to talk to somebody about that, but that's been the arrangement. So next week will not be an offering for the Phillips family until we hear further from them. But in tithing the 10%, that goes to God. And when other opportunities come for offerings and contributions and things like that, which are indicated here, that we don't borrow it from the tithe and designate it for another work. Following? If you're tithing $500 a month, you don't take, you know, $100 of that and divert it to the Phillips family or something like that, because that's no longer tithing. You're no longer tithing to the Lord. And so understand that in a very practical sense. Now, I realize as I've been talking that there can be this sense of pressure. I realize that's a very real thing, and that believers have to come to grips with that. They have to come to grips with the pressure of what income you have, what necessities you have, and God's requirement of giving. And you need to come to grips with it to the point where your giving is with joy. You can give with joy. You will give with joy. You come to joyfully give. And that may require some exercises of thinking and looking at the scripture and yielding to first things first in spite of the pressure and looking to God to bless so that your giving is met with His blessings, because the giving is going where His blessings are intended to go to. You may need to do like they did in Malachi, you know. Test me on this, he says. And see if I won't open the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing, since you have been willing to give, if you're willing to give. I understand that there's a test. I believe tithing presents a wonderful and great test for faith. Now, here's what I mean by that. I don't mean that in giving a portion of to the Lord, right off the top, that you're faced with this kind of test of faith. Lord, I'm going to give you your portion, and I'm going to believe you to make sure I have all my bills paid and everything we need, and that we will just have everything that we have been having it. Let me say that a different way, a better way. A family has a number of things that they enjoy, and the pressure of tithing comes to bear, and they say, I'm going to trust God to keep all the things we enjoy. What I mean by a test of faith is a test that God knows how much blessing you need. God knows how to increase that blessing. God knows how to keep your blessing at your level to develop other things in your character, in your life. God knows that there's some things you really don't need in your life that you have been expensing that need to go. And that kind of pressure is one of those ways of doing that, to make you reevaluate what you have and what you really don't have to have. It's a real, I believe, test of faith or confidence that, God, I really believe I can live on the blessing level you give me. I really believe if I need a higher level of blessing, you can provide it. And we're willing to live on the blessing level you've provided so far. And if that blessing level, that income level is not sufficient, Lord, show me what I can do to live within your blessing level. And I believe it's a test of faith to enter into that with a believing and trusting in God that He intends for you to live within your income and not take from giving to Him in order to do so. I believe some people think it's a test of faith if they start giving tithes, it's a test of faith to believe God that they won't have to miss out on anything if they start tithing. I believe it's a test of faith to remain obedient even if you start missing out on some things. Now, I'm going to give you a for instance. It's just a for instance that I just used. And I know this is, I'm going to use it as a for instance because it's a real for instance. It is a, for instance, that I think everyone can relate to the significance of it, not just an ethereal or made up, for instance. But when push comes to shove, you really don't need a dog. Now, I say that in the context because everyone knows how dogs and children get along. And how torn up people might be to take a dog away from children. I say in the context of knowing that that can be a very real thing, affectionate thing. And beyond just the ideal talk about something where nobody's affections gets involved. But I believe those are the kind of things that even though there's great attachment to things, a living thing, that is up for negotiation, if necessary, in order for God's blessing to arrive at his household. I use that as a for instance. You might have more for instances that you can think of that affect you more personally that those things are addressed. Like soda pop, candy at the door from Girl Scouts. I mean, maybe we don't take those into account until we begin to feel the pressure of put upon us and brought upon us by the consistent giving of tithe. And those help. Helps. Feeling the pressure helps. Pressured can be a very helpful thing to awaken our minds and keep them awake until we address things that need to be addressed. Now, we're at a real significant time in the year. And I don't think I've answered every question that you probably could come up with regarding giving and tithing. No, Ron says no. Okay. I understand that. Lots of my sermons have unanswered questions, and I understand that. And I sometimes answer them or see that after preaching. I understand that too. But maybe you don't. But we're at a significant time of year called Christmas. And we know what that means. It's about children, and it's about presents. It's about money and buying presents. And it's a very real live case of facing circumstances in which the circumstances call for buying things because of Christmas and the level of income that you have and whether or not you're going to borrow to buy Christmas presents or live within the means that you have. And face your children with that, instruct them, and deal with it, etc. I've been in this circumstance where January 1st comes and I get a call from a tenant that says, we're going to be 2 weeks late on our rent. You know why? It's Christmas. They spent my rent on Christmas. I've had that happen. You know what they've done? They've stolen from me. They have. They've taken money that they vowed to pay me on time, and they've taken it and used it for themselves. They've stolen from me. They made me Santa. Mm-hmm. They made me Santa Claus. Uh-huh. Or they made me a banker, but they didn't ask me if I would agree. They just did it. To have God's instructions for us to give, and I believe the tithe is a real true track and way of giving. To have that from God, and then to divert some of it at Christmas time or other times in the name of paying it back later or something, I think is to make God Santa Claus or a banker, because it's without his consent. That may sound harsh, crass,
doesn't seem nearly so harsh and crass until you've been there and somebody says you're not going to get the income you need this month because we spent it last month. You've been on that end of it. There's a whole different scenario of how you believe you are viewed by the people and how you think that they view the importance of your responsibilities and your bills and their vows. And I think that's very helpful to get a sense of our giving to God and how it's viewed to Him if we postponed it, diverted it for anything at all. So, this is not something that I don't believe I've ever spoke on. I think I have one sermon entitled Giving that I spoke on giving. But without these thoughts to it, and these are not complete thoughts, I believe that there are other ways to draw this out and apply it and understand it. But I believe this is helpful to those that I've had conversations with and to give a general to everyone at the same time a view of what I believe is all of our responsibility in giving. And you have to deal with that as you have to deal with all issues between you and God. And my responsibility as pastor to have some relationship to that giving in the sense of addressing it if I believe that there's failure and find out what your thoughts are and what's the point of difficulty with you. I believe that your giving is between you and God in the sense that nobody needs to know the amount that you give. But I believe your giving is not just between you and God in the sense that to the degree of being faithful in giving, you are upholding your portion of responsibility so that all of us have a place to worship and can labor together to whatever doors God may open up for us now and in the future. And that where there has been continued and faithful giving, it's laying in store for the future whatever God may indicate He would have a people do. And at that point in time, they don't have to run back and try to make up for failure in the past. But that those heaps are there. And those heaps can be counted on. And they can be planned on. And they can have made commitments made by them. And it leads a people in what they do. And not just begrudgingly wrung out of them because they plea with such pleas of need and shortcomings and stuff like that. And I believe that in a revival, it's finances are always addressed at some point in a revival, like it was here in Hezekiah's time. At some point when God is blessing people and they're entering in and receiving from Him, their pocketbooks, our pocketbooks, always will be addressed. And I believe that is a dividing point oftentimes between people's advancing and staying in the blessings of God, meaning a spirit of revival, or finding themselves hardened and dropping off because God has touched one of the two most important things, their pocketbook or their kids. And we want to talk this out, to look at it, have an understanding, and start or continue doing what you're doing and sharing one another. Your giving, as I started to say, is between you and God as regards the amount, but in faithfulness and everything that affects other people. It may, if done faulty and not done, may affect the very people you pray for because the means or supplies will not be available, etc. Or if it should come to where the doors are closed, it would be because there had been faltering along the way. Or where there's the need for the servants of those who lead in the worship to be provided for that wouldn't be done unless there was faithfulness all around. So those are the various aspects of giving. And I would ask you to look at that. Jesus talked about the Pharisees and warned the people about their hypocrisy. You remember that?
He told them, you tithe of the herbs and spices. Those little, you know, herbs and spices are such minor things. He said, you tithe of those. You take 10%. You know, you take 10% of the garlic and you set it aside. You take 10% of the herbs and spices and you set it aside. Take it to the temple. But you neglect the weightier matters of the law, like justice and love and mercy. He says, I want you to do the justice and the love and the mercy and not leave the other undone. Understand? So he didn't rebuke him for tithing. But he did rebuke him for just tithing and doing it in a fashion which was without, entirely without the spirit of love and the spirit of the law. So he called them to embrace and take into their hearts the spirit of the law as well as that exactness of the law. But didn't rebuke them for tithing. And I think that gives us reasons to believe that God would not rebuke us for adopting a tithing method, but never adopting it as a mechanism for righteousness and leaving the other things neglected. Never neglecting love, mercy, and justice in the law. But not neglecting tithing either. I think Jesus authenticates tithing, at least to my mind, sufficiently. And I think it is, for all the reasons I've tried to lay out to you, a justifiable and reliable guide to our giving to the Lord. Okay? Let's pray.